This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism, hashtag podcast, hashtag broad on Joy 94.9.
This podcast is presented to you by Broad on Joy 94.9 at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival. Broad presents Mothering from the Fringes.
Okay, so in coming up with this panel and this conversation, I wanted to look at how it is that despite the fact that the types of families we have and the circumstances in which we end up raising them are so incredibly diverse now, and two-parent, heterosexual, nuclear family seems like something out of a 50s, well, I won't say sitcom, but although it can be kind of TV drama, that it still seems to be the standard against which everybody else is measured. And if you have a family that is outside of that, it isn't necessarily good with hostility, but you're assumed to be trying to, well, not trying to say that it is just like this other normal family model, only different, which is the same, like people of colour also, when people are being tolerant towards us, we're kind of told, oh, well, we're all the same, really, only you're just like us, only different. But really, just like us. We're really all human, aren't we? And so I wanted to talk with Miriam and Anastasia about how it is that why we are still, that particular model is still so resilient, and how we negotiate and how we use our writing to talk about navigating through this discourse when your family somehow, or at least is perceived as not seeing, fitting that template. And so, and Miriam I got to know because she was editing a book called Mothers and Others, to which I contributed. So, available for sale at, you know, at all good bookstores and the stand at the festival here. And so I was thinking that we might also refer to some of the other motherhood experiences that are in this, like, because they're, as I said, it is and others, and like Celeste Little is one of the contributors there who does not have a biological or adopted child of her own, but who talks in her chapter about how it in her community, she's Aboriginal community, you can perform that parenting role, you know, in other ways. And so maybe in the discussion period too, we can talk about the multitudes of ways you can perform the mothering role. But I'll hand over now to Miriam, and I'll let Miriam and Anastasia introduce themselves, really, except I will start off by saying that I'm really thrilled that in the time between the program being drawn up and this today's panel, that Anastasia was shortlisted for the Scribe Nonfiction Award, which she is going to be it's for a work that does discuss this very topic, so I'm really pleased about that. Anyhow, but Miriam, do you want to go first?
Sure. So I am primarily a fiction writer. I hadn't engaged with this topic very much in my fiction when we... I'm also part of a feminist editorial collective who put together this book and a book about female friendship. And it was such a fascinating process publishing this book, and just hearing this diversity of women feeling squeezed into this sort of normative box that I don't think really exists. So my particular family structure is I am in a same-sex relationship. My partner and I have a five-year-old daughter. We are very sort of, we're very normative in almost all respects. We have quite a sort of I guess a fairly sort of heteronormative family structure in terms of like she is the breadwinner and you know, and I'm the primary carer, and I'm really conscious of how this very structured way of familying we've incorporated it wholesale. And I was thinking a lot in the lead up to this panel about the things that Shahira was talking about in terms of how we how we all feel co-opted by this sort of mainstreaming effect of traditional whatever it is. So whether you're talking in terms of you know, dominant white society, dominant sort of family society. And my experience of it has been really interesting in terms of feeling like having a kid has sort of brought me into the mainstream in this way that I won't say I didn't expect, because I was told to expect it by a friend of mine who was a baby making trailblazer in my little group of friends, and she said to me, like, it's amazing, like you go into these spaces where once you would have expected a level of low simmering hostility, and the world is actually a lot less hostile when you are a family, when you embody that sort of safe normative unit, I think, for the most part. And I probably have to qualify that quite heavily in terms of a level of socioeconomic privilege. I think we live in a fairly little gay ghetto. I live in the inner north, like it's you know, I know that I'm probably amongst friends for the most part. But yeah, it has been a surprising like journey into the mainstream. I felt embraced and welcomed in a way that has been awesome on a day-to-day level, and deeply kind of itchy and troubling on an ideological level. And I haven't engaged with that much in my writing, I have to say, other than for the piece that I wrote for this book. That was the only time that I have written an overtly autobiographical memoir-style piece. I mean, it was still fictionalised, but it was sort of incorporating wholesale my experience of like crossing over into this weird parenthood realm. I think that I had a couple of really bad experiences early on in terms of writing lesbian characters, and I was thinking about this when we were talking about how we incorporate our own stories into writing, because I write mostly fiction, and I think when I was younger I did tend to write, you know, my agency characters tended to probably be me and Avatar. And I had a couple of sort of close but no cigar publishing experiences of people saying, this is great, but why is the main character lesbian? Why is she gay? Because it wasn't a character point. It wasn't something that sort of was, you know, necessary to the plot or anything like that. It was just, it hadn't really occurred to me that she shouldn't be. And I think maybe on some level I sort of internalised that and have not tended to fictionalise my own experience that much, which has been a little bit of a confronting realisation.
I'll talk about my own take, because it's a way of introducing Anastasia as well, because and I'll talk about it as an offspring. It stuns me. You think that people of different races have been having sex with each other and producing babies, fertile offspring, you know, we're not like mules, we can have babies too. That shouldn't really be seen as particularly, although it's been illegal in various societies at various points in time, but you think that now it's normal, and you think that now, but it still is seen as somehow making a statement, and sometimes that's greeted with a lot of hostility. I mean, I get a lot of emails when I mentioned having a white mother, saying that I shouldn't, no reason to brag about having a mother who committed race treason, you know. But if I think back to, like, I feel like I remember this, but I think I was just told about it, sitting on my mother's knee in the doctor's surgery, and the doctor coming out and looking and saying to me, where's your mother? I'm like, my mother sitting here. And but then on the other hand, my own daughter is more fair-skinned than I am, and having spoken to other brown women with fair-skinned kids, yeah, that seems to be like the fair-skinned mother with the dark baby is international adoption, and the dark mother with the fair-skinned baby is the nanny. And I got given a lot of advice about how to look after this child who clearly wasn't mine, and I wouldn't realise, you know, I wouldn't realise how to stop them from getting sunburned was one thing. I do get sunburned myself, you know. I do know that my daughter... Anyhow, so yeah. That doesn't seem like it should be such an exceptional, exceptional situation, and yet it is. And then when it does get... And then it often gets, you know, cited in these positive terms. It's this huge anti-racism, the harmony of mankind. If you remember those Benetton ads that used to have this feature, that kind of united colours of Benetton with white mothers with brown... You know, and I used to feel self-conscious with my daughter that we would look like a Benetton ad just walking around town. I have talked about this topic with Anastasia, and because quite a lot of white mothers had conversations, and Anastasia's piece that she was shortlisted for the Scribe Award for talks about motherhood, and I will hand over to Anastasia for her take on this.
So thanks, and just I'm very new to even calling myself a writer, so I'm incredibly nervous. There's writing things and then there's being a writer, right? So they're really different. It's something... motherhood is something that I had, I think, thought about quite a lot before I became a mother, but I think had thought about very... not very well at all. And I think that's a lot because of... I don't think I was always offered good insights into motherhood, and so I struggled a lot to make sense of it when I did become a mother. And I think that one of the things that I wonder about, because there's this extraordinarily powerful discourse of motherhood as normative. It's incredibly powerful, and Miriam talks about it, and I'm a straight white woman, so that my access to normativity is obviously pretty high anyway, but certainly you become like a kind of a certain kind of woman, and it's also been interesting for me that... like pregnancy has been one of the times that I think I've been most conscious of my racial privilege, actually, in terms of being this kind of a fertile female body, and the kind of respect and I guess gentleness or something that you get, which is, and I certainly know that that's not always extended, particularly to women of colour, in pregnancy, and Shakira has a story in her book about not about being pregnant, but about being with her little cousins who were mistaken for her kids, and so the potential hostility to the fertility of women of colour compared to white women being quite at times quite overt.
And one of the speakers on, I don't remember which panel this morning, just briefly referred to Aboriginal women being referred to as cash cows.
Sure.
Because of, you know, like welfare generators, but yes.
So it's this, and this is the thing that I've sort of, that I really struggle with, and I don't think that I've at all made sense of this yet, but that it has this incredible force towards the norm, towards creating something that's normative. And even Miriam was saying that her family starts to skew heteronormative, even though it definitely kind of can't be. But it isn't a normative experience. When you actually go through it, it is not. It is weird. It's abject and messy, and it's really weird. And so And so this amazing thing happens where somehow, somehow this, what should be completely undomestic and unheteronormative, because I think, the maternal body really betrays its kind of imperative to be something consumable by men when it gets pregnant and when it breastfeeds and stuff like that. Like, I often think that part of the anxiety about public breastfeeding is that, like, when a baby breastfeeds, you think breasts belong to babies. You know, men don't know what they're doing when they go to the breasts. You know, a baby, like, swoons and its eyelids flutter and, you know, and it sort of groans with delight and, like, puts on this performance, and it's just like, you watch it and you think, well, that's what breasts are for, you know, holy moly, you know.
I remember thinking, this is not many times where you think you have made another human being perfectly happy.
Yeah.
Just there's nothing more that they want in the whole world.
Yeah, and so I often think that people say that they feel anxious, that they don't like that they see the breast, but I think that often people don't like seeing the baby sort of, you know, swooning in this kind of extreme pleasure. So all of these weird things, I mean, and there's so many things that you could say about it. Like, the other thing is about how, like, particularly when you're pregnant, you have a kind of an abject body and a body that creates anxiety in people around you, which is like, has some vague similarities, I imagine, to experiences of disability, that sort of thing, of the way that you're looked at and the way that people feel anxiety and stuff. And yet, it gets somehow rendered into, tugged away from that completely to being something that's actually violently normative, to the point that, and I wrote my proposal to the Feminist Writers Festival a long time before Sonia Kruger was saying, as a mother, you know, that motherhood was so normative that it could actually be weaponized as an instrument of racism. And so that was like a very lovely little illustrating of this thing, which I was trying to get to. And actually, I really feel like Miriam's piece in Mothers and Others, which is about a mother's group, for those of you who haven't read it, it's about a mother's group and these women kind of going through this experience of often of breastfeeding for the first time in public, which is a very, you know, can be a really full-on experience. And it spoke to me so strongly for my own experiences of being in mothers' groups and how uncomfortable that experience could be. And I wonder if the discomfort was that domesticating of something which was so primal and frightening and joyful and intense, being domesticated into this sort of a bit fussy midwife telling you what to do, and having to keep up appearances to this other room full of women and having to pretend that you weren't feeling, that your body wasn't feeling pain, for example, which, you know, your body often is, almost always is, after you've, you know, just giving birth and are just establishing breastfeeding and stuff like that. So all of these, I wonder if it was that sort of binding up into normativity that I responded to so painfully in your piece. Yeah.
I had, in the terms of my own life course, but I like, yeah, I was still, it wasn't exactly a surprise that the interracial, or whatever you want to call it, of parenting, but then my own body started to. I had spent my whole life working out to what extent my skin mattered or didn't matter, what I used to answer as a child, and a child who, in retrospect, was like a fairly upper self in some regards, was to say, it doesn't really matter what skin colour it is, it's how good your brain is. And I thought, at age like 6 or whatever, I was fairly confident that my brain was pretty fucking good at that moment. But then actually it turned out that somewhere in my DNA or whatever, there was the multiple sclerosis and my immune system turned against my brain, and my brain, which I had just, yeah, had always been my ancillary prejudice against my skin, is like, I will destroy you with my awesome brain, you little white idiot. Sorry, hashtag not all white people. I was suddenly, you know, riddled with lesions, apparently. Well, not apparently, it shows up in a scan. But, yeah. And then that intersected with the with the not the normative racial mother and offspring thing in kind of interesting ways too, because as my daughter started to grew up very fast and would be taking on this reverse parenting role, and then people then interpreted that as this, it's a cliche because it often happens, of the mother, migrant mother, having the offspring who speaks, acts on her behalf. And so it would just be because my daughter got impatient with things being too complicated, so she would say, if we were waiting to board a plane, she'd just go up, step up to the counter and say, my mother would like special assistance to board early, please. Could we put, and all of that. And then they would then assume that I couldn't understand the conversation, couldn't speak English, and they would, okay, fair enough, given that she'd just turned up and been so adult about it, but then they would kick me in this, like, patronising, double patronised as the disabled woman and the, the non-English-speaking migrant woman. And, so it's, there's this pile up in multiple and complex ways, but, yeah, I'm very, very aware of having had able-bodied privilege for a long time, and certainly, prior and in the early stages of becoming a parent, and that women with various types of disability have to fight and sometimes go to court in order to assert their entitlement to become mothers and to have kids. And Stella Young, who much missed Stella Young, wrote about how when she was a kid and she needed her appendix out, I think, and the doctor said, oh, well, we could tie her tubes while we're in there, because they assumed that her parents would not want her to ever have children. And there was a Senate committee inquiry a couple of years ago into this, and this was the ongoing forced sterilisation of disabled people. Primarily women is where the focus is on that. So, like, and then this continued stigmatisation. Well, a former Hawke Keating cabinet minister, published a book last year called No Contraception, No Doll. And that, you might have read op-eds, that is saying that if you're going to get Centrelink, then you should have to have long-term contraceptive devices as a condition of that. And when he was, when it was suggested to him that this would impact particularly on Aboriginal women, he said, well, yeah, right, exactly, and so it should. He wasn't the one who'd used cash cows, but he drew upon that. It didn't bother him to think that this would be a very racialised policy if it were ever put through. So, it's interesting the way, I think, some groups of women get stigmatised, white tertiary educated women get stigmatised for having too few babies and too late, whereas other primarily brown, lower class women get stigmatised for having their babies too early and too often. That Anastasia described in my book, it was because I was a quite young woman and with three little cousins, and young enough to have several more, and I could, as you said, people like with a kid and they respond well. And that is my expectation, that who doesn't like little kids? But seeing me walking around with this little, and I was used to kind of racist microaggressions. This was in London. And so we were like packies, to speak British speak. Who doesn't like little kids? Well, lots of people, and well-behaved little kids. But no, that's a threat. I heard people say too many.
That's really interesting to me, coming from the other side of that, of that, normalisation experience of becoming the proper family model. It's interesting to hear that can work in the other direction, which clearly it does. I am coming from it. So for some reason, my experience mostly
as someone with, you know, this particular form of difference in my family makeup, is that it makes me safer. Whereas clearly for other people who embody different kinds of difference, it makes them more dangerous.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, and again, referring back to which is a mostly book about Muslim women's not mostly, it is a book about Muslim women's experience after 9/11.
The clues in the title.
Yes. Muslim women from victim to suspects. 9/11. But yeah, anyhow. There's this YouTube video on Muslim demographics which says that Muslims are going to defeat us through terrorism, but also through demography, by having more babies, you know, and it has all these graphs and showing, you know. And see, this is a two for one, really, because it's stigmatizing both white women for not having enough bums and Muslim women for having too many. Like, you know, what's not to like about that if you're a right-wing troll?
And I think that, because I've sort of wondered about, I guess, where feminist writing can engage with this better, and I think that sometimes the issue has been that because feminism has perhaps been too white, the feminist way of writing about motherhood has often been from that perspective of experiencing a lot of pressure about getting pregnant, and very unambiguous pressure that you should be having babies. And so that...
When you're having the next baby.
Yes, that's right. And so that in general, when like white feminists have written about... I mean, of course I'm generalising, but that when white women... feminists have written about motherhood, it's been from this position of kind of defiance, from this exhausting, constant, relentless pressure. And I think that certainly for me, I've found that feminists of colour have often written, a little bit more ambiguously about motherhood, which is, I think, almost the only way to write about motherhood, in the sense of... I guess in the sense of engaging with a bit more complexity around it. So, and Shakira mentioned Celeste's essay in the Mothers and Others collection, and I thought it was really interesting that while she very much has a very unequivocal feminist defence of, you know, of her decision and of course her bodily autonomy and right to make that decision, she also lets in this kind of possibility of a bit of ambivalence about the fact that she is a mother, and I think that and I found that very moving and interesting, and I think that that's perhaps women who haven't been so aggressively told you must become a mother, you must, and so unequivocally from all sources might be a bit more able to sort of see the productive and powerful potentials or the attractive potentials in motherhood when it hasn't been so uncomplicatedly rammed down your throat. And the other writer that I was very inspired by when I was sort of thinking about pregnancy was a Native American feminist called Andrea Smith, who has a chapter in her book Conquest about forced sterilizations is mainly what it's about. And that grief for that lost potential was actually the first... I was used to feminists writing about abortion rights, you know? And to read about the right to your own reproductive capacity, to exercise it, to not have it taken away from you, to not have it shamed or policed, it was the first time that I'd read something like that, and I found it incredibly... moving. I guess it was the first time that somebody had presented motherhood to me as a feminist act and something for feminists to defend. And I
was surprised that that Senate committee, that Senate inquiry that I referred to a few years ago into forced sterilisation, wasn't taken up in a more major way. It wasn't ignored, but it wasn't... Well, I guess it's partly what gets media attention, but it didn't get the kind of headlines that the various demonstrations, you know, or not demonstrations, but when there were demonstrations outside abortion clinics, and then there were feminists pushing back against that. As I said, I think that's also
an issue of media priorities rather than feminist priorities, but still, I was taken aback that there wasn't that the forced sterilisation, that the control of fertility in the other direction wasn't being. And I also thought that that these other demonstrations, which were against the the pro-choice activists, I thought that could have been a useful entry into that to say, oh, and while we're talking about this topic, there is this other, going on here. Did you, were there any particular writers, you mentioned what a friend told you about how you would be welcomed into heteronormativity, were there any writers that sort of you read during that period of time that kind of navigated you at all, or not really?
That's an interesting question. I'm sure I'm going to wake up in the middle of the night thinking of reams of inspirational feminist writers writing about alternative family models, but of course I can't think of anyone right now. I think that for me, the image of motherhood and of that kind of the sellable image of the family is so tied up in that very, it's this sort of commodification brand of motherhood that gets schlepped around to sell things. And I don't know, I feel like I maybe haven't read much that, that exalts that as an ideal, because it is something that's so ubiquitous in terms of our cultural currency and our, and I do feel like it's quite heavily tied up in selling things. I feel like, there is this image of the family and everything that the family needs, which is, so sort of such about commodification culture and female bodies get tied up in that. And I guess I'm sort of saying the same thing that you are, that I feel like maybe most of what I'd read from a feminist perspective and from a queer perspective had been arguing against that, that overwhelming commodification of what should be, like you say, this quite, purely individual and terrifyingly abject, wonderful but messy experience. So yeah, I don't know that I have any writers to bring to that party. I would be really interested if anybody else does.
Well, I think it's intriguing the extent to which it's this, like a norm, but then it's but then you're being somehow special for doing it if you're not the norm. Well, once I was visibly disabled with my daughter, it was like, good for you, amazing. Like, for what? Not putting her up for adoption? It's just like, I'm just living, we're just living. And then also, people feel the need to comment. I'm pushing her in the pram and this, the pancake parlour, Alice in Wonderland, of all the freaking people, just looked in the pram and said, wow, she looks so Anglo-Saxon. How did that happen? I'm going to go, come back down the rabbit hole.
That's always sort of refreshingly in your face. I read your piece, Anastasia, about the conversation, where people get to the point
where did that come
what
from?
They want to ask is, how come your baby is brown? But they don't actually say it. They just leave the space for you to feel. Whereas that person clearly was comfortable just filling the space.
Yeah, that's right. And that's definitely that thing and I guess that's part of the kind of normativity, because then when you deviate in just one way, my family is so normative in every other respect of class and gender, and that's what I should say, is that so my partner's not white, which obviously means that my kids aren't. And I wrote this piece. A friend of mine was starting this website to discuss kind of biracial and bicultural identity in Australia and asked me to write a piece, which I thought was going to be so easy. I was like, yeah, of course, I'll just bash that out in an afternoon. Not a problem. You know, it'd be a pleasure to do because I feel like this is something I think about so much. And it turned out to be incredibly difficult, actually, to write, and I had to kind of rewrite it so many times and send it to her and get her to help me with it. And basically, it kind of, I think because I was wrestling with myself a lot more than I had realised, and what I wrote about was this thing which I call the conversation, which is when people who hadn't met my husband would go to me, and they would never, honestly, in none of these examples, would they fill in what they meant. But I would always know what they meant. And so it was this really interesting, they'd get this certain look on that. I'd actually got to the point where I could know, oh, here it comes, you can ask me.
I used to answer at one stage. I figured I stopped doing it because I thought it would give my daughter the therapy bills would add up. Because I would say, oh, actually, well, of course she's not biologically mine. I acted as a surrogate for the Swedish couple that they had. I'm still waiting for my last $80,000. So Ulla and Henry can't have her yet. And, but people actually seem to think that that was the more likely explanation. So this is also the thing. I'm a bit, well, quite a lot further along this path than that. It isn't something that you are ultimately working out all by yourself either. Your kids get, you know, that's directed, or as they get older, it's directed at them too. So it's a narrative and a story you have to work. And writing now, I need to be. Well, I always tried to be mindful, and as she got older, she bloody well never let me forget it, of that, you know, that if I was saying anything about her, then she, you know, she had boundaries, she had privacy, she had, you know, and she did read this one before, you know. And I asked her permission before signing up to do it. But yeah, so even if you're the only one who's sitting there and writing it, but actually there are.
Which is such a terrifying thought, I find. The idea of them being integrated into this process of negotiating your difference in the world. But I mean, not even getting to the at my stage, I can't quite imagine my daughter being able to read, so I'm not there yet. But just, you know, just on the level of noticing the differences and noticing people's reactions to difference. And I think you say something, Anastasia, in your piece about sort of coming to the realization that on some level you have to trust. Is it Otty? You have to trust Otty to make sense of it and to not just be trying to shield her in your responses because I guess because they're going to be.
Yes.
Yeah,
well, I think about it a lot about her getting that question when I'm not there. And so that was the thing, actually, I think the part that I was wrestling with myself about is that I'd always want to give like a... I never wanted to be irritated, although I was, but because I wanted... I was worried that she would interpret that as a negative response about her or her identity or something, and so I'd always try and respond in this kind of cheerful way and really participate. And what I found is that then I'd get this kind of like a almost kind of aggressive approval where they'd say how kind of great it was, which I didn't enjoy either. And so it was funny. So over the course of writing the piece and wrestling with myself, I made this vow that I was going to stop answering. And I was going to start being difficult about it. And the amazing thing is, since writing that piece and since kind of making this resolution, no one's asked me that question. And I think that I've started to maybe have a bit more of a bit of a back off kind of attitude with people, which no long, where I no longer, I guess, allow that before it even gets started. So I guess that's a funny thing about, like, I guess about bound, you know, about bound and about, defending your family.
Well, yeah, I get asked this by mothers in your, or people, mothers, or, you know, mothers or women who are planning to become mothers, about how to raise their kids with issues that they didn't have to face themselves as they were growing up, how to raise kids, you know, to be able to negotiate a racist society. I mean, they, you know, sorry, just saying those words, I kind of think we do need to, you know, teach white kids how to do that too, but like, I guess we assume that you don't need particular qualifications to do that, or whereas, well, I suppose that if your experience growing up has been substantially different to what you expect, yeah, and I can never quite know what to say to that question. Did you? I don't think you asked it of me, did you? I don't remember.
I might have done. Yeah.
But I just would say, well, like, to trust what they tell you about the racism that they're facing, and to not, because it's, with, well, anything with your kids, you want to tell them it's not a big deal and that it's okay and that it doesn't really matter. But, like, you know, but people of colour get told that all the time. Mm. Oh, just shrug it off. Just forget it. Mm. Just, you know, don't take any notice. You know, ignore them and they'll go away. And, like, they won't, for a start, and it's, and so to listen, I think, would be the main one for me. But have you, are there conversations that your community has, sorry, but that mothers in your situation have about, do you feel like you kids will need to be guidance on that?
Oh, yeah, or? Yeah, no, definitely. We're in a rainbow play group, which has been a really interesting experience in the further sort of normalising of the whole queer community for me, because it is, for the first, I think, maybe 6 months or something that we were there, I didn't realise that Georgie, my daughter, didn't understand what the rainbow bit of it was about. I mean, I think I referred to it as rainbow playgroup, but I think she just thought that there was, you know, there was a rainbow the day we went or something. Because, of course, it's always the same parent who's there with their kid. It's always the primary carer. Mm. So there's no visual difference, despite all of them being, almost all of them being same-sex families. But, you know, we talk about it fairly obsessively in terms of, like, the how to respond to questions and how to field curiosity and, you know, questions about dads and what to say to the kids about dads. And so far, I have to say, the kids have sort of done better than us in terms of just assimilating it without any kind of apparent, you know, neuroticism. Like, they do talk about it, and I've heard George have conversations with her friends about having two mums, and it does seem to just be a thing that she, you know, it's part of her, it's part of the background of her world. I don't think that she has internalised it as a point of trauma at this stage. I don't know, touch wood.
I was interested when you were saying about, oh, in your particular neighbourhood, how it's a safe space in the inner north for families like your sister, and I live not that far away, similar to, and to me it's a safe space because there's lots of niqabis and you know, visible Muslims.
It is. I think that's tied up. Yeah, and I've always lived except for a brief period when I was a teenager, I've always lived in fairly inner urban communities, and I do think there's a real luxury of diversity there. And when we briefly moved to the suburbs when I was a teenager, I hated it, and I hadn't identified as gay at that stage, but I think that was part of it. I think it was the sense of sort of crushing uniformity
that you, I think, that you don't tend to get in inner urban areas. There's a safety in that diversity. You know, you're just one of a whole crowd of difference. So,
which goes against stereotypical expectations that and given the the post Orlando discourse in particular about homosexuality and Muslims, which I'm not going to say that there aren't some a lot of very homophobic Muslims, and yet in these neighborhoods I'm not going to say it's all just one great big rainbow family of religion and sexuality and, you know, and race and everything else, and yet we seem to chug along.
Yeah, I'm nowhere near brave or qualified enough to make any kind of generalizations about Muslim culture and homophobia. But on the level of personal experience, all I can say is that I have never experienced any homophobia from the Muslim community. I have experienced homophobia from the old Hungarian relatives community. I've experienced, you know, homophobia from, very subtle forms of homophobia from what I think of as a very sort of middle class, mostly middle aged white community.
I find it intriguing, some of the right-wing, basically homophobic voices that are saying we can't allow Muslims, like we can't have a mosque in Bendigo because they'll bash all the puftis.
No, because these people are so worried about the gay.
All of a sudden, everyone became a feminist because Islam hates women, and now everybody's waving the rainbow flag because Muslims hate gays. I don't know. From families, but yeah, it's
There's so many fascinating, contradictory, assumptions and piggybacking assumptions in that. I think maybe that should be your next book.
Okay. Anyway, shall we open it up? And for just general on this topic of what do we do with this that families will be found, you will have your family with a person of the opposite gender but the same racial religious background as you, and literature that talks about that. And yes, over there.
Sorry, it's actually a little bit unrelated just to something that one of you guys made a point about earlier. Yeah. When you talked about when you read the text written by a Native American writer and you found that you never thought of motherhood as a feminist act before. I'm wondering what you guys have to say about young women who become mothers, because I have a really close friend of mine who's about to become a mother, and she's very young and she chose to do so, and throughout her pregnancy I've been the one thinking and constantly reflecting on what that means in terms of my own perspective on motherhood at my age and my anxieties and insecurities about that.
And so do you mean that she's too young? Like,
oh well, that idea around getting pregnant when
Yeah. Well, that's, it's kind of a class, not necessarily always, but often that young pregnancy is this thing that poor women do. So I think that's...
Poor and brown women.
Totally. So it's completely, I think, bound up in that thing of that it happens in this precise right way. And there's kind of almost like this real struggle to talk about it when it doesn't. But yeah, absolutely. And people have written kind of defences of young motherhood, which is, often a ridiculous term because it's like a woman who's 22 or something. Like, it's not like her body's underdeveloped or anything like that. But it is seen as weird. And again, it falls out of this perfect normative thing, which as we talk about it, you start to realise how very, very narrow it gets,
I think I heard someone over here say it used to be
It used to be normal. And I think that's interesting too, that, like, you know, within the course of one generation, that, that window of normativity has quite violently shifted. So where, you know, I think you would probably be considered to be a bit on the shelf if you hadn't done it by your mid-20s.
I was, like, pre-gravida when I got pregnant at 33.
Yeah.
An old lady they had to take care of me.
And yeah, they talk about, you know, there's that term, elderly
migrant. My grandma had her babies at 43 and 46. And she, I mean, she was like that. She was a very kind of lady to the world in general. And but yeah, I think that she was basically considered a social freak. She
was like, yes, so, in front then? Oh, with the boots? Sorry.
You touched on ableism. I was actually a young mother. I took my first is 16, was intellectually differently abled, still took up in quite an all hands-on way.
Yeah.
I just wanted to maybe hear opinions on that. My own experience being a white middle-class woman, even though I'm by myself, is I usually get people feeling sorry for me or feeling sorry for him. He's quite happy. It's pretty cool. But the other experience I've had, again, I've grown up a white middle-class, but moving through as a single mother, probably lower SES financially, moving through that space, I can move to different areas for services and I can argue for those services. And I'm often asking, because there's little services still, and even going with the NDIS, I've asked this question, I have to argue and I have to make his still as bad as they can be. I'm his voice in two different ways. I do some poetry and I do it with him. But on the other hand, I have to see my worst case scenario so I can get any funding. And then my next question is, what about the people that can't speak English? What about the people that, are hurting enough that they don't want to come in here and talk about how hard it is? And how is that enabling my son too to have his own voice? Or, you know, the
ableist
for the differently
abled
community. So, just
to
hear your thoughts on that.
I'm still, you know, learning on this front. But, yeah, there is always this, because, and around the NDIS as well, and I know it's not something, it's not a discourse that's created by parents, but of disabled children as a burden and their parents as burdensome and their parents therefore as self-sacrificing, which I'm not saying, it's, you know, I mean, any kind of parenting is hard work, but in a way that stigmatizes the kid, you know, and I find it, well, with my own daughter too, like, I'm torn between needing to, you know, she's entitled to have her, she puts in, has done since she was, like, declared Sydney Morning Herald Home Cook Hero of the Week when she was 8, because she taught herself, you know, because she got sick of living off muesli, basically, and she, you know, and she took, you know, and so she taught herself, and she deserves to be praised for that and acknowledged for that and thanked for it lavishly, but at the same time, you know, I'm still here, I'm still her mother, and I still perform that mothering role, and again, but then you try and, but then my daughter doesn't need to grow up all the time just hearing, your mother is amazing, because she's still your mother doing ordinary mum stuff, you know, while she has multiple cirrhosis, that is amazing, instead of, no, that's just life, and sometimes it's rough, but it's just life, there's nothing amazing about continuing to live it. So I know that's a bit of a long way around it. I am really so incredibly sorry, but we are out of time, and I would love to continue to explore these themes, and maybe I hope that we'll have the chance to do so over the other things, but I don't want everybody, the next panel, to be running behind time. So thank you so very, very much, and thanks to the other two. And this.
This has been a special broadcast from Broad at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival on Joy 94.9.
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this Broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune into us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy for feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.